So welcome to the Dhammagiri Sunday program, everyone. So before we start our discussion, I thought I'd talk a little bit about some concepts that are very useful for meditators and basically anyone trying to sort of control their minds. So in the Buddhist teaching, we have this concept of Suttamaya Panya, Chintamaya Panya, and Bhavanamaya Panya. And so this word panya means wisdom, and then it's giving three different sources for our wisdom. And so the first is sutta, and sutta means to hear. So in the Buddhist time, of course, people would actually come to a teacher and listen to the teacher. So they wouldn't read about things in a book, and that's why we have this word sutta. And so the second one is this chintamaya panya. So this means thinking. So normally we're asked to listen to the teachings, and then we're supposed to think about them and reflect on them. We're supposed to recall them frequently, and then we're supposed to develop them. So this word bhavana means development, but we translate it as meditation because it's talking to a large extent about meditational development. So we have these three aspects. And so why do I bring it up? Well, we're going to do a little bit of this chintamaya panya. I'll give some sort of teachings you can think about. And then, because with a group, it's not that easy to do the meditation side, right? You have to do that yourselves later. But we can bring up some teachings, and then we can hear them, and we can process them ourselves. Now, one of the concepts that is quite common, or quite, you could say, fundamental to the Buddha's teaching is this word, ahara in Pali, which means nutriment. And so the Buddha talks about various different kinds of qualities in our minds, and then he talks about what is the nutriment for that quality. So how do we nourish that quality? And so then he talks about the opposite. So in Pali they use a negating particle, and so then ahara becomes anahara, so it has an un at the front. So they say something like, literally non-nourishment, but we can say starving, the starving of the hindrances or the starving of the enlightenment factors. Now, when we are trying to understand about these qualities, first we have to try to understand what the qualities are. And so we can reflect on what the qualities are, and then we try to develop some and try to lessen others in our mind. And when we're doing that, we have to think about this ahara or anahara. So what kinds of factors are nourishing those qualities, or which factors are leading to the decline of those qualities? And so in the Sanyutta Nikaya, there's some suttas in the Bojanga Sanyutta, and they're talking about this, how to starve the five hindrances and how to nourish the seven enlightenment factors. So I'm not sure if everybody knows the five hindrances. Do we have some? I think my sister Malika maybe knows the five hindrances. Can someone list one of the hindrances? You can shout it out and I'll repeat it for everyone.
Ill will.
Ill will, okay.
Sensual desire.
Sensual desire, okay.
Doubt.
Doubt, good, three. It's, yeah, can, yeah, that's a good question, actually, because some people say that doubt it can be can block you from entering completely if you don't have some faith. And so we have which other ones, which other qualities are hindrances? Sloth and torpor. And then we're down to one.
Restlessness.
So they are one and a half. Restlessness and remorse, we say, uddacca kukkuccha. So we have our five hindrances, and as Gary said, maybe this one of doubt can be the strongest. In some cases, it can block us from actually starting. So the Buddha gives some similes for the hindrances, and actually he gives a set of similes, a few sets of similes, but one of them are the water similes. And so for doubt, the simile is you're trying to look at your reflection in a bowl of water. And what happens to the water if someone has a lot of doubt? What kind of water are they looking at? No, not that one. So it's sort of the water is hidden in a dark place. So it's like murky water, and looking at it in the dark, you can't see anything. So that's the simile. So if you're trying to look at your reflection in the water and your mind is filled with doubt, then you won't be able to develop your path to practice. And so we'll give the five similes, then we'll talk about the different factors that are sort of nourishing these qualities and that are leading to their reduction. So what's the next water simile? Oh, we won't do it in order because we're already starting from the reverse side. Boiling water is ill will. So you're looking at your face in boiling water. And so everything that you're seeing in this water is completely distorted. Completely distorted. And then, so three more similes. What about restlessness? What kind of water is restless? I think, yes, now we come to that one. So water that's all whipped up by the wind, sort of a lot of waves and sort of turbulent water. This kind of water also, if you look at your face in it, you won't see a clear reflection. Okay, now we're down to two more. So one for sensual desire and one for sloth and for laziness and sleepiness.
Sorry, I'm just thinking what would be a possible. So the sensual desire, you're looking at water from which poison is rising.
So we had a suggestion, not a guess from the sutta, but a suggestion that the sensual desires could be like something that's sort of poisonous. The vapors are causing us harm. And so this kind of simile is seen in some other suttas, like the simile of honey on the tip of a blade, like this kind of thing. But in this particular sutta, we're talking about different simile. And so we have a similar analogy in English. If somebody is overly optimistic, we say that they are looking at the world through rose-colored glasses, right? So similarly, then, if we're looking at our face in a bowl of water that's been dyed a green or a yellow or blue, we can't see the actual color of the reflection. I think the last one's was more difficult to guess. So for the sleepiness and laziness, the simile is water that is covered over by moss. It's grown over by moss, so we don't see anything when we're very sleepy. Now, the significance that the Buddha says with these similes is that when our mind is overcome by one of these hindrances, we don't know a few things. So we don't know what's for our benefit. We don't know what's for someone else's benefit, right? And we don't know what's for the benefit of both. So we can't actually analyze the situation in a clear way when our mind is overcome by these hindrances. And so then the Buddha gives us these instructions on how to reduce them in various places. So maybe we'll get some suggestions how we reduce the hindrances, and then I'll give some principles. We'll try to systematize like how the Buddha is teaching this, because he actually gives us sort of groupings of how he does this. So how can we reduce anger or sensual desire? Yeah, so that's right. Yeah, so the Sister Malika has given away the game here. So the principle is yoniso manasikara, or wise attention. But I think that we need to unpack that term a little bit. It's not that simple to understand without some concrete examples. So maybe we'll get some concrete examples how people might reduce anger or desire or doubt. Okay, that's fine. So when we were talking earlier about the nourishment and then the starving of these qualities, and so the Buddha has given sort of some hints on how we can do this. And so especially the method is this yoniso manasikara, so to pay attention to particular aspects of the object. And then we have to be sensitive to which, paying attention to which aspects leads to which result. And so going back to the suggestion that doubt can come first, when we have too much doubt, then we're paying attention to an object or some kind of concept in a way that leads us to sort of turn it over and over again in our minds, flipping back and forth without coming to a resolution. So normally when we talk about doubt, we're talking about the kinds of doubt that lead us to, like, that prevent us from practicing the Buddha's Dhamma, that prevent us from meditating and doing good deeds and things like this. But we can also have similar kinds of doubt in our life about what kind of decisions to make, and then the mind can get trapped in these circles, sort of flopping back and forth between two options. And so so the Buddha recommends that we see what we kind of have to investigate what kind of way of thinking about that is leading to the doubt, and then we have to try to break out of it. So some practical examples, one thing we can do is sometimes we can set things aside for a while. So you can think of maybe like an author who has writer's block, and then sometimes they can spend a whole year, they can't figure out what they're going to write next. And then they decide, I'm going to surface paradise for 3 months, and I'm just going to lie on the beach. So then, or they decide, I'm going to volunteer for UNICEF in Somalia, and I'm going to give up my job. And then sometimes later, by sort of changing their focus, then they're naturally able to sort of resolve the issue. And so another source of wisdom that can help us resolve doubts is this kalyanamittata, so noble friendship, right? Spiritual friendship. So if we have somebody we can trust, or a group of people, we trust their Dhamma knowledge, their experience in life, then we can meet with them, we can discuss things. And sometimes if they don't have a solution, but they may have some kind of advice to help you find a solution, or maybe they know some sutta you can read that might have some useful information. So then we're going up, we go to Udaccha Kukuccha, then we come to restlessness and remorse. So somebody who's suffering from this one, they can suffer a lot. Some people have a lot of pain from their past, and then when they sit down to meditate, they just keep churning it up again and again. And this is, I think, in our society, it's very strong. I think one reason, possibly because we have a lot of records of what we've done in the past. So we have a lot of photo albums, and we have Facebook, and we have videos of ourselves from the past, whereas 2,000 years ago, maybe the memories would fade a little bit more. But for whatever reason, people have trouble with this. So what's one way to deal with it? Go ahead, Stefan.
Just a question. The restlessness, is that always the restlessness based on remorse? Because one could have, temporary restlessness due to some overexposure, overstimulation of whatever.
So the question is about this restlessness and remorse, and whether they're always linked together. And whether there are two types, one type that is more like I was just describing, where somebody has some sort of grief or remorse over something that they're churning over, and one more innocuous kind where they just feel sort of restlessness. They don't sort of feel comfortable sitting still, or they're just not settled, but they don't have a deeper cause. So it's a good point, and it's true. There are these two aspects of it. And so we can have different causes for restlessness, and it can be as simple as you ate the wrong breakfast, you had too many bran flakes for breakfast, it's not digesting, or you're not used to eating meat, and then you had a big piece of fish or something, you can't digest it. This can lead also to a certain amount of restlessness, and there are hindrances to our meditation, but typically, the more profound problem, the one that people need more advice about, is the other kind of restlessness and remorse, where they're remembering things. And so this one is difficult. I don't think there's only one aspect to it. But so coming back to this theme of wise attention, yoniso manisikara, that the Buddha is advising us to apply, one way to do it is to look at the broader circumstance of your life or of that time period. So some people, they have a lot of regret about how they treated their parents when they were children. They weren't respectful for their parents, especially if their parents maybe passed away when they were young. They can have this kind of regret. And so in this sort of case, one thing is just to reflect on the nature of childhood. So, I mean, we all wish that we sort of had the whole life's worth of wisdom from the age of 7 or 8 years old. But if you work with children, then you know that a 7 or 8 year old, they view the world in a very different way than we do. And then as we age, those memories sort of, we almost imagine like we had all of the options that we have now. Then like now maybe you can speak 6 languages and you have different kinds of degrees and you have a job and you have your own children. But when you were 8 years old, you were just struggling to sort of, your parents were struggling to make you go to school each day. And so it was just a completely different life. And so if you think about the context, then sometimes you can, by this understanding, it can help to reduce some of this remorse. If it's not in that case, like sometimes the memory is not so far back, but then we can look at the course of the whole lifespan. So then we can think about all of the things that are happening in our life. And so we can contemplate, well, what did I do this week? And sort of back, what did I do last year? And then sort of, what will I do in the future? Imagine I live to the age of 80. And you can sort of contemplate like the whole lifespan of 80 years and put it in the context, then yes, I made some mistake at that point, but at other points in my life, I also did good things. And like no one is able to always make the correct decision. So we're applying this as a strategy to reduce the grief. So if you find you're doing this and it's not working and a grief gets stronger, you're thinking this is foolish, it's useless, then in that case, it's not the right method for you, right? This is a practical method that we're trying to actually reduce these kinds of hindrances. So we have, I'm sure there are more methods, but no one seems to be suggesting, so maybe we'll move on to the next hindrance. So when we come to the laziness and sleepiness, so then again we have two aspects. So the one is simply sleepiness, which is less problematic unless you have some kind of physical disorder. And so it often can have just a simple problem, like simple cause, could be the weather, could be not enough sleep the night before. The laziness can come from a sense of complacency sometimes. It can come from discouragement. Then sometimes we feel that we've been practicing meditation for a long time and it hasn't sort of come up enough. So typically we have, well, I opened the floor. How do we overcome laziness? Does someone have a suggestion?
Energy to investigate.
Sure, yeah. You can increase the investigation power. Investigate mind and investigate what object?
Whatever object you choose.
Okay, sure. So whatever your meditation object is, you can apply more investigation and less simple concentration. So this is one, this is a very valid method. Another one is to, another?
Just it is, you can't control it when you stand up and do some work in meditation.
Okay, so if you don't feel like sitting meditation, you can get up and do walking. So this works, I think, yes, yeah, so this can build energy. So we can change our postures as well. So one way is to do it through faith also. So some people, if you're from a Buddhist background, then maybe you like to offer flowers. I see some people like to offer flowers and candles to the Buddha Rupa. And for them, these kind of things bring up faith and energy. If you're not from a Buddhist background, they might not. So it depends on the character. You have to sort of know yourself. That way is one way, but we can contemplate the Buddha's qualities, or we can read some stories about the Buddha or some kind of arahants or monks who've practiced hard, nuns who've practiced very well in the past. And then the other side is to develop this sense of urgency and then to contemplate this death. And then in one place, the Buddha has given some instructions about counting down our lifespan, how many seasons we have, how many years we have, how many weeks we have, how many days, how many meals, how many breaths, all these things. And then we can contemplate this uncertainty of life. This one is suitable. You have to check if it's suitable for you. So we're trying to bring down the hindrances. If you start to get some kind of negative reaction, then it's not the right method for you. So that's three. Three down is pretty good. Now two more. So for anger. Yeah, sure. So if we can develop metta or loving kindness meditation. Usually we have to do that before. If you haven't done it yet and someone comes up to give you a whack, then it's probably too late to start trying. So there should be a lot of strategies, because I think everyone here has been angry at some point. We all have strategies. Can take time off.
You're numb and angry. You can just move away from the situation.
That's true, yeah. So to take some time away from, to withdraw yourself from the situation. So if you feel like you're, maybe your boss has blamed you for something, then you're really angry with your boss, you're going to tell her what you think about her, then maybe better not to tell her that. Then you can wait till the next day, you can make a better plan. This is what the Buddha said: when we have these hindrances in our mind, we don't know what's for our benefit and what's for somebody else's benefit. So because of this, we can't act in a very sort of useful way.
Two people
angry is worse than one person angry, right? It's worse, yeah. We also have other tricks. So some things can be almost like, if you think about a boxing match, then we say you cannot hit below the belt for a boxing match, but when you're fighting the hindrances, it's okay to hit below the belt because you're trying to win at all costs. So you can use some tricks. Some people find they know that they feel more calm if they go for a jog. They do some kind of physical activity, or they like to drink black tea or something like that. So you can change any kind of activity, essentially any kind of harmless activity that's replacing the anger is in that case is going to be beneficial for you. Even there was one study that was dealing with fear, and it was dealing with people who had developed this post-traumatic stress disorder from combat. And the study had asked them to do a task that maybe some of you have done in the past, and that is to play Tetris. So every day they had to play Tetris for 30 minutes or 1 hour. So some of you may be too young to remember Tetris. I don't know if it's still popular, but anyway, so it's just, so they had them play Tetris for, I don't know, it was a long time, like 30 minutes or an hour a day for a number of months. And then afterwards they did a brain scan. And then they had found changes in their limbic system, their emotional system, and they'd also found changes in the amount of fear. And so they were able to treat these sort of traumatic memories by playing a video game. So, I mean, normally monks don't recommend people to play video games. It's not sort of a common meditation instruction, but if you're able to do something that's quite harmless and able to remove this kind of sort of harmful intention from your mind, then we have to consider, as I say, hitting below the belt with the hindrances is okay. And then we come to sensual desire. So usually, this one, the Yoniso Manasikara, the Buddha says we should pay attention to the asubha nimitta, which means the unpleasant aspect of things. So whatever object we're attracted to, we can pay attention to some aspect of it that we don't like for whatever reason. And so there's actually a sutta, there's some suttas where the Buddha talks about this ability that the arahants have, the ability to see a beautiful thing as an ugly thing, and to see an ugly thing as a beautiful thing, and that they have mastered this ability in order to maintain their minds equanimously. So sometimes another way to deal with some kind of strong desire, so sometimes it can be a habit. It can be like sometimes, for example, somebody likes to go, they like to go and play blackjack at the casino or something. It might not necessarily be like a strong gambling addiction, but they want to cut down on that. Then they can reflect on the negative outcomes from that, the negative effect it has on their lives. So again, we can recontextualize it by thinking about the effects it has on a longer scale. So if it's something really harmful, we can think about the bad karma that's involved. If it's something just that we like to change in our lives, I would like to reduce, then we can just reflect on what kind of effects that it's having on our life. So we have these, for the hindrances, we have the different kinds of non-nourishment or starving of the hindrances. Then the Buddha also gives the ways to nourish our good qualities. And again, a lot of it is this wise attention. But I think maybe we'll just end this part of the discussion there and see if anyone has any other topics they'd like to discuss or any kind of questions. Okay, so this is the problem that was just raised is that some people, when they meditate, then they start to feel very calm, and then they fall asleep, and then when they wake up, they feel refreshed, and then they think, oh, my meditation's really developing. I have some kind of special samadhi. So yeah, this is a real problem. And so normally, the way to overcome this is to have a friend hit you over the head while you're meditating, not with their fist, but with a piece of cloth or something. You can take just like a rag or drip some water on your head. Actually, the important thing is, because when people get into this trap, they really can be hard to snap them out of it. So I know one person had this problem, and every day he was meditating and he's falling asleep. But then he is telling his teacher, oh, his meditation is very good. And then the other meditators are looking, when they hear the explaining this, they're looking, you're sleeping all day, then you say your meditation is good. But he wouldn't believe the situation. So what they finally did was they had to take some photos. And they brought him the photos as evidence, you know, you're sleeping in your meditation. I think not everyone will be that. I think for most people, this only happens time to time. But if someone really gets into this situation for a longer time, sometimes they need someone to help them snap out of it. But they have to trust you, right? If they don't want you to snap them out of it, then don't bother them.
So every time I start to think about the Dhamma, I fall asleep, say. It kind of means that I don't want to think about these things. I want to dream and be in my wishful thinking. I don't want to think about the world the way the Buddha explained it.
Right. Okay, so the first one that you mentioned was about when somebody is falling asleep when they meditate, and it might be that their mind is trying to avoid thinking about the Dhamma practice that they need to do. Is that correct? So this is also possible. So of course, our mental states can cause some kind of physical states in our body, and they can affect. So it is possible that in some cases this can be the problem. If that's the case, it's not that easy to cure this sort of situation. I think that kind of meditator needs some help from a teacher over a longer period to overcome that. The other issue is, I'll try to summarize. So when we're living our lives, then we can't go around having absolute certainty about everything. And then if we want to make decisions, we want to understand things, then we have to have a certain amount of skepticism towards it in order to spur on an investigation and deeper understanding of it. Is that that's sort of the general situation. And so then this is, so when we're talking about, I think this kind of question comes often because the Western philosophical systems have a little different use of terminology than like the Indian, sort of Indian analysis. So what we would call something like a healthy skepticism or this kind of doubt about things in maybe Western perspective would probably come under investigation in the Buddhist system. So then when we talk about this Vimamsa, we talk about investigating things or under Dhammavicaya Sambojanga, it's also investigation of states. And so so that's the first part, but then what to do about the situation is not at all clear. So just to know that. So actually the first thing then is to understand this doubt that the Buddha is talking about here is especially things that are specifically blocking us from trying in our Dhamma practice. And so that means that we have to have a certain amount of faith in the Dhamma practice before this hindrance will even come up. And that is to say that if we look in the analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Arahanta Dhammadina, the Chula Vedala Sutta, she's explaining that the wisdom aspect of the path is actually the Samadhitti Samasankappa. So the first sort of two factors of the path, so right view and right intention, I think those are the common translations. So this is actually the wisdom part of the path, but it's actually also the entry point. And so before we really start our Dhamma practice, earlier I was talking about this Chintamaya Panya, so that the wisdom that comes from thinking about things. So we actually have to read some Dhamma, and then we have to analyze for ourselves a little bit to understand that is it the case that our actions have some kind of results, some kind of ethical quality to our actions. So maybe you won't, maybe you'll still have some skepticism towards rebirth or something, but you can see, for example, that somebody who's always angry and somebody who's always lying and maybe they like to give false lawsuits or something like that, then this kind of person, even if we don't know about future lives, but we can see that they may seem to be getting a lot of money, but the people around them don't like them, right? There's a different kind of cost to that kind of behavior. And so through this kind of, we can say, reasoned analysis, and then we have to develop a certain amount of faith. And then once we've got to a certain amount of faith, then we have to take, at some point we have to essentially commit to that and say, okay, now I've already analyzed that. And then as far as I can tell, this seems to be the case. Maybe later I can go back and look at it again, but for now I'm going to take this as like a guiding principle. And if we don't do this, then sort of we get sort of trapped in this cycle of skeptical thinking. And especially for meditators nowadays, like I said earlier, this word sutta means hearing. And so in the past you would go to a teacher, you would request some kind of teaching, and then essentially you'd have to try to practice it to find out about it. But now you go to YouTube and you see what they're teaching, and then you search reviews of so-and-so and see what the results are. And so then we're kind of, it's a different process. And obviously not everyone is doing this, but it's the kind of trap that some people fall into with this doubt. And so then they not only with Dhamma things, they find like some kind of products or something, then they want to buy something, then they start looking at reviews, oh, maybe this one's better, maybe this one's no good. And so at some point we have to decide the kind of meditation is enough that we can trust it, to practice it for now. The teacher that we're with and the community we're with, maybe we can't say they're practicing perfectly the way the Buddha did, but it's enough to trust them for now. And so then we have sort of stepping stones on our path. So it's a very good question, important question for us.
Can you put the doubt aside all together and fake it to make it by practicing, working on the other hindrances, eventually go back to the doubt?
Yeah, so this is the question, the suggestion is maybe we can fake it till we make it and work on the other hindrances until the doubt disappears. So this is, yes, it's a very valid way, a way of practicing. One way to look at it is from, there's a teaching called Vitakkasantana Sutta, and it gives five ways to reduce our negative thinking. And one of the ways is simply to change your object. So you can focus on your breath instead of focusing on your the parts of the body or something. And try another way that it gives is just to ignore the hindrances. So you can just ignore the doubt. According to the Abhidhamma system, if we have some kind of a good quality in our mind, that time it will push out the negative quality. So in this kind of teaching, even if you're just focusing on your breath, if your concentration starts to come up, then the doubt won't be there. So, and people can experience this if their meditation's picking up, all of a sudden these doubts disappear. Like, where did they go? All of a sudden they're gone. So for experienced practitioners, I think this is a good method. For beginners, it might be difficult.
Strong faith, and then the doubt can be just set aside.
Yeah, so the suggestion is if we have strong faith, then we can simply put down the doubt. So this is true, but actually, the Buddha mentions that we should balance our faith faculty with our investigation faculty, this vimamsa. And so you can see the danger now, if you sort of just set aside all of the doubt, sort of, we won't say set aside the doubt, if you set aside any kind of investigation of things, then you can sort of be taken in. Somebody can sort of slip some sort of logical fallacy in there, then sort of lead you on the wrong path.
I find I get very emotional after my meditation practices, and I'm wondering if that's because I'm asking questions like, who am I, and what was I like before my parents were born? Just wondering if that's something I should be doing, or if I should try and be emptying my mind instead so I could feel more calm and happy afterwards.
Okay, so the question is about sometimes this meditator feels some agitation or sort of a bit excited after meditating. And so I think there are two issues. The one is some people have different reactions to meditation. And so then if the mind isn't becoming calm and we find that the hindrances are increasing during the meditation, it's very helpful to discuss with somebody about it, because there can be quite a variety of causes for that. As I said earlier, sometimes the physical situation can affect our mind. But there can be other reasons, many, many other reasons. So in this case, we have a suggestion. It can be coming from a certain meditation method, like thinking about who am I and who was I before my parents were born or something like that. So the Buddha actually doesn't recommend we meditate that way. There's some suttas where he says that this will just lead to further thinking. So if we are meditating on these things, we can't actually resolve these kinds of questions. And so the Buddha recommends we focus on, he gives a lot of different things we can focus on, but essentially for the most part, we're trying to develop some good qualities of mind, sort of our concentration, our wisdom, and we're trying to reduce these hindrances. And so then later we can sort of cycle back and we can develop our wisdom more. so by a more direct investigation. So if you want to know like about karma, how karma works, then we can't just think about it. Then you have to develop the concentration and the investigation sort of according to the different processes of dependent origination. So it's not sort of a simple thing. So maybe if you try just focusing on the breath.
So would you please guide me from the first step, how to meditation in your
eye? Okay, so this is for a question about how to meditate for beginners. So this depends on the character of the meditator. So usually if somebody, we prefer that, like in our monastery, that people will learn like a few different types of meditation. But for somebody who doesn't have access to a teacher and they're practicing alone at home, then one way is to start with the breathing meditation. But because it's not that easy at first to focus on the breath only, then there's one section of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha is talking about mindfulness of postures. And so he talks about being mindful when we're standing or sitting, and then also when we're moving, walking and reaching out. And so we can start by just paying attention to the shape of our body. And so our body, we'll talk in a simple way, we have certain qualities, like the body is heavy, right? It has some kind of heaviness to it. And it's sort of being pulled together. The skin is sort of holding it together. The bones are holding it all up. And so when you're sort of standing there, you can feel that, like the softer parts of your body are sort of being pulled down by gravity, the harder parts kind of holding it up, and sort of just feel what the body is like in that posture. And when you sit, if you do this while you're walking, or standing for a while, then your mind will start to get into the meditation sort of zone. Then do you feel more like meditating? And then you might want to sit down, and you can pay attention to the posture while you're sitting down. You can even experiment with your hands a little bit and see, like, are you more comfortable here? Are you more comfortable here? You see what kind of effect it has on your mind. Because for meditation, of course, it's essential that the body be comfortable. Assuming you're not ill or something like that, but it's essential to try to make your body as comfortable as possible. But the main goal is to train our mind to be able to overcome difficulties. So once we have found the posture that we feel comfortable in, we can focus on the breath. And usually in our tradition, we focus on sort of this area around the nostrils. And it's not necessary to focus like very fiercely at one point exactly, as long as you can feel the breath coming in and out there. Some people have trouble with this, and there are some tricks if you can't feel the breath clearly. Some people use they have these diffusers, and if you have a peppermint oil diffuser, it actually, this is not my invention. One of our teachers, I heard it in one of his talks, he recommended somebody couldn't feel the breath, they could put peppermint oil here. Then later I saw somebody had a diffuser, which is, I think, much more reasonable than just applying it to you. So, and then you can just focus on the breathing in and out. And if the mind starts to think, and as we know, minds think, that's what they're there for. So don't worry about it. So when your mind is thinking, you can bring it back to the breathing. The danger is only certain kind of thoughts. So then we were talking today about the five kinds of hindrances, the five kinds of negative thoughts. And so when these come in, then we either, if they keep getting stronger, then we have to do some other technique to reduce them. But if they're getting weaker just by focusing on the breath, then there's no need to do another thing. So I think for somebody just starting out for meditation, that should get you quite far. If you can do that, then you're doing quite well. Okay, well, it looks like we're all running out of voice today. We've talked you all out. So thank you so much for coming this Sunday at Dhammagiri. And so we hope that you may all be happy, healthy, peaceful, and content, and swiftly attain the peace of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.